Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the Indiana Court of Appeals ordering a new sentencing hearing for a Gary man serving 183 years in prison for two slayings when he was just 16 years old. Brandon Smith reports on some new laws that have yet to take effect in Indiana. A special prosecutor has been named in the police-involved South Bend shooting, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Jim Weiser, chairman of the Lake County Democratic Party. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The Securities and Exchange Commission is suing a financial advisor over a deal involving the Library District in Harvey, Illinois, and that act has at least one Gary municipal official concerned. Comer Capital Group and its managing partner, Brandon Comer, are among the officials who helped Gary last year and put together the sale-leaseback deal. Gary hopes to use its public safety building as collateral to obtain a $40 million loan that will provide cash to enable municipal debts to be paid. Councilwoman Lavetta Sparks-Wade has long opposed the deal, saying it takes on far too much debt to be a responsible financial move. She said the fact that Comer is now being investigated by federal officials for a Harvey Library deal ought to be reason enough to be suspect of the Gary sale-leaseback deal. The Common Council and Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson have signed off on the sale-leaseback as part of a larger deal that includes U.S. Steel Corp. and is meant to bring in significant revenues to city government. Sparks-Wade points out that the bonds generating the $40 million have yet to be sold. Sparks-Wade's objection focus on the fact that the $40 million would be repaid over a 20-year time period with interest payments exceeding $27 million on top of the principal payment. The SEC lawsuit contends that Comer Capital acted improperly with regards to Harvey, did not meet its responsibilities of meeting its fiduciary duties to the Harvey District, and wound up costing the Library District at least $500,000 in interest payments. Specifically, the lawsuit says Comer failed to handle the underwriting of bonds properly, deferring to IFS Securities, which had no experience in handling bonds such as those of the Library District. IFS has agreed to pay $50,000 in civil penalties and hire an independent compliance consultant to review procedures. Sparks-Wade said she viewed Gary's financial deal with millions of dollars in interest payments likely to be paid by the city as far worse. She even went so far as to compare Comer's actions to those of Bernie Madoff, who pleaded guilty a decade ago to a multi-million dollar Ponzi scheme for which he is serving a lengthy prison term. Attorneys for Comer have denied any wrongdoing. Council President Ronald Brewer continues to believe the sale-leaseback deal is a financial measure Gary needs to engage in. Brewer said he has looked at the Comer involvement in Harvey and said he sees no comparison between what he is alleged to have done in that community compared to his actions in Gary.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
Authorities in Northwest Indiana say two people have been arrested in connection with the shooting death of a 16-year-old who was attempting to sell an Xbox. Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez tells the Post Tribune a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old were taken into custody Wednesday after the office's tactical unit executed search warrants at two homes, one in Gary and one in Crown Point. Martinez adds the two were being held in the Lake County Jail. Gary officials previously said that Johnny Peluria of Miraville was shot June 12th after he and his father arranged to sell the gaming console to someone who had contacted them online. Martinez said authorities will seek to charge the 17-year-old as an adult.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The Indiana Court of Appeals has ordered a new sentencing hearing for a Northwest Indiana man serving 183 years in prison for the slaying of two men when he was 16 years old. The Times reports the court decided 3-0 that a ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court that life without parole for juveniles is cruel and unusual punishment similarly applies to cases such as Donnell Wilson's, where the sentence effectively is a no parole parole one. The Gary man could be eligible for release in 2104 when he would be 107 years old. No timeline for resentencing is set. The ruling could be appealed to the Indiana Supreme Court. Court records say Wilson, now 22, fatally shot brothers 19-year-old Shaquan Ham and 18-year-old Charles Wood in a 2013 gang territory dispute in Gary's Glen Park neighborhood.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Amtrak's Hoosier State train completed its last round trip Sunday. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, some who had trips planned before the state stopped funding the train are now left to figure out how to return home.
Lafayette resident Janet Mayer has been riding the Hoosier State line for about a decade. She purchased her ticket before it was certain the line was ceasing operations. Now, she'll have to find a new way home, perhaps having her husband drive to pick her up. Mayor worries losing the train also means losing some of her ability to travel.
As I get older, my flexibility of going where I want to, when I want to, is curtailed. And no senior likes to think of their life collapsing on them.
Governor Eric Holcomb declined to make continued payments for the train, one of the funding priorities in this year's state budget. And cities along the line had long said they couldn't pay for the service on their own. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana Department of Child Services is responding to a class action lawsuit alleging the agency is failing the children in its care. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on what DCS Director Terry Stigden has to say about the suit brought last week.
The lawsuit, filed on behalf of 9 children, seeks policy changes at DCS. According to the complaint, some of those children have been shuffled between foster homes more than 15 times. But DCS Director Terry Stigden says the lawsuit is cherry-picking cases. In a video statement, she notes the average number of foster homes a child in DCS care lives in is 2.
Put frankly, DCS is simply not the agency it used to be. And continuing to rely on an outdated, inflammatory account is misleading and harmful to children and their families.
Stigden's statement outlines the progress she says the agency has made over the last year, and she says the lawsuit won't distract DCS from its mission to continue improvement. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
While most Indiana laws took effect July 1st, there are still a few that aren't yet being enforced. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that includes some gun license changes, a new type of gambling, and a measure for the wrongfully imprisoned.
Indiana will now have a fund for innocent people who've been wrongfully incarcerated. It will pay them $50,000 for each year they were behind bars. But if they take the money, they can't sue the state. The measure takes effect November 1st to give the state time to set up the infrastructure. Similarly, sports wagering won't be legal until September 1st because lawmakers want to give the Indiana Gaming Commission time to establish rules and regulations. Sports wagering will be allowed at casinos as well as via mobile and online bets, but the commission says the mobile portion might not be ready to go by September. And beginning next year, July 1st, 2020, Hoosiers applying for a 5-year handgun license will no longer have to pay a fee. Some law enforcement agencies worry about that change because some of that money goes to them. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana University kicked off its bicentennial celebrations Monday. The university doesn't officially turn 200 until January 20th, but has celebrations planned throughout the 2020 fiscal year. Bicentennial banners are up at IU campuses across the state, and the university delivered special boxes to departments full of items to help start the celebrations. While many of the big events don't happen until the fall, Bicentennial Project Manager Jeremy Hackard says there's ways for people to get involved throughout the year. Faculty, staff, and alumni can participate in oral history interviews.
It's a way for us to record the history of Indiana University In a different way. It's not just looking at this president did X, the Board of Trustees voted to do Y. It's what was it like to live in the dorms?
The university is also accepting nominations for its Bicentennial Medals. They recognize those associated with or who have served the mission of the university during its first 200 years. IU President Michael McRobbie awarded the first Bicentennial Medal to Governor Eric Holcomb Friday.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The head of Indiana's State Board of Education will soon lead Muncie Community Schools. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Stephanie Weichman reports, district officials say they've hired more than just a superintendent.
Dr. Leanne Kwiatkowski brings a long resume to Muncie, including 18 years of classroom teaching and serving as chief of staff for the state's Department of Education. She says it was Muncie's unique situation, run by Ball State University in the first of its kind legislative mandate in the state, that will see her relocate.
Quite frankly, I believe that this is the most exciting job in the state of Indiana, if not the nation.
She'll now take up a title almost as long as her current one, Director of Public Education and CEO of Muncie Community Schools. According to School Board President Jim Williams, that's because the job asks more than it would from a superintendent. Kwiatkowski has signed a 3-year contract with the district and will begin on July 11th. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Stephanie Weichman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Most of Indiana's teachers started or completed the process to renew their licenses this summer. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports a new license renewal requirement went into effect Monday, largely causing the massive uptick.
Teachers renewing a license through professional growth plans now need some kind of career awareness training, like an externship or some other experience focused on career needs. Department of Education spokesperson Adam Baker says districts can decide what that means for their teachers.
You know, because there's no formal definition of externship and no formal definition of career navigation, those two can absolutely be locally defined.
But confusion and frustration about the change caused most of Indiana's teachers to start the renewal process ahead of July 1st, largely to avoid the new rule. More than 50,000 of Indiana's teachers started or finished the process between May and July 1st this year. That's nearly 10 times the renewals this time last year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Dozens of protesters gathered in front of U.S. Senator Todd Young's office in Indianapolis Tuesday to protest migrant detention camps. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports the demonstration is part of a nationwide protest of the conditions at these camps.
Close the camps now!
Protesters left comments at Senator Young's office opposing the camps and asked him to stop family separations at the border. Cindy Cervantes-Closser brought her daughter Elena to the protest. She says the image of the drowned Oscar Alberto Martinez Ramirez and his daughter Angie Valeria in the Rio Grande hit home for her. Her brother-in-law is from Guatemala.
Watching a baby and her father drown coming over here, I don't know how anyone can think that
it's okay.
It's okay. I don't understand it.
Indianapolis was one of more than 180 protests organized by the left-wing group Move On. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A number of measures to address Indiana's high infant and maternal mortality rates were adopted during the past legislative session. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on the new laws which took effect this week that aim to drive down the rates.
Indiana has higher rates of infant and maternal mortality than the national average. One new law will create a statewide program to connect mothers with perinatal navigators throughout their pregnancy. Republican Representative Cindy Kirchhofer authored the legislation and says another provision requires providers to verbally screen pregnant mothers about substance abuse and refer them to treatment if needed.
Work with them is to say, hey, you have a problem. Would you like to seek help? And can I help you get there? and to be compassionate and not punitive.
Another law allows minors who are at least 16 to make their own health care decisions during and after pregnancy, and legislation to reimburse doulas who provide support for pregnant women also went into effect July 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Documents filed in a South Bend circuit court name Richard Hurdle as the special prosecutor who will oversee the investigation into the police shooting of 54-year-old Eric Logan. Hurdle has been the prosecuting attorney for Ripley County since 1998 and serves on the board of directors for the Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council. He replaces St. Joseph County prosecutor Ken Cotter on the case. Last week, Cotter requested the appointment of a special prosecutor in order to, quote, avoid any appearance impropriety. Mayor Pete Buttigieg says he supports that decision.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
It's been over 2 weeks since a Black South Bend resident was fatally shot by a white police officer, but the pain and outrage ignited in the community have not gone away. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks brings us the timeline and context to give insight into how this incident sparked an outcry.
It's been more than 2 weeks since a Black South Bend resident was fatally shot by a white police officer, but the pain and outrage ignited in the community have not gone away. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks brings us this timeline and context to give insight into how this incident sparked an outcry.
It was just before 3:30 a.m. on Father's Day when South Bend police officer Ryan O'Neill responded to a call about a suspicious person at an apartment building.
There's a subject in the north parking lot wearing all dark clothing with a flashlight, possibly breaking out windows.
Prosecutors say when O'Neill found Eric Logan stepping out of a car, he had an 8.5-inch knife raised in one hand and a purse tucked into his waistband. Then O'Neill yelled several times for Logan to drop the knife before firing two shots, one hitting him in the stomach. Sergeant O'Neill called dispatch moments after.
Yeah, I'm fine.
O'Neill says he's fine, but adds,
another unit here, guy threw a knife at me.
The guy threw a knife at me. An additional officer rushed Logan to the hospital in a police car. He died shortly after. And as Logan's family discovered his death, they had lots of questions. They say he was a devoted father who was planning a family barbecue to celebrate Father's Day with his kids and brothers. And although he'd been convicted of drug and weapon possessions in the past, they never knew him to steal from cars. Even if he was, they asked, did the incident require lethal force? And why was he moved to the hospital in a police car rather than waiting for an ambulance? Here's Eric Logan's wife, Shafonia, that evening.
It's a lot of rumors out there, but nobody know what went on but the police and him. He's not here to tell it.
When it was later revealed Sergeant O'Neill's body camera was not turned on, uncertainty became outrage. To many, Logan's death was the latest in a long history of racially charged controversies involving the South Bend Police Department. The biggest one was in 2012, when a Black police chief was federally investigated for secretly recording officers using racial slurs about him. And to make matters worse, subpoenaed documents showed several cadets Sergeant O'Neill trained in 2008 claimed he made racist remarks in front of them. And the officer that transported Logan to the hospital, Aaron Knepper, had been investigated several times for misconduct. Community members had called for him to be fired 4 years ago. At a vigil for Eric Logan, Councilmember Regina Williams Preston said that history of misdeeds was exactly why the city council spent $1.5 million to implement body cameras last year.
We said it. What is it going to take? Is it going to take a Black man to be murdered by the police of South Bend?
They did that.
How can we trust our police department when we put all of those elements in place, but we don't follow through?
South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg left his presidential campaign immediately after Logan's death and attempted to calm the outrage. He asked the police chief to remind officers to turn on body cameras for all civilian interactions, but said he couldn't fire them and wouldn't ask the chief to resign. Frustrated by the lack of changes in police policy or punitive action against officers, people admonished Buttigieg in person when he attended a protest.
In front of all these cameras that Black Lives Matter.
Did you just ask me if Black Lives Matter?
Yes, you say Black Lives Matter.
Of course Black Lives Matter.
Then fire your cops!
Fire your cops!
That afternoon, in response to demands for an independent investigation, Buttigieg promised to write a letter to the Department of Justice. Separately, the St. Joseph County prosecutor asked an Indiana circuit judge to appoint a special prosecutor. After Logan's funeral, people are still outraged and wait to see what's next. Buttigieg recently promised a public process to discuss policing practices, but he gave no specifics.
The last couple weeks largely consisted in the community needing to express a great deal of hurt and officials needing to absorb that pain. Now it's time for us to be acting.
He returned to the campaign trail the next day. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
There's been a lot of attention given to how your online browsing habits can be used by companies like Amazon and Google to target you with ads. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports, one Indiana startup is now using the same techniques to help solve the state's brain drain problem.
On Purdue University's campus, graduates in caps and gowns are lined up, waiting to take a picture under the school's iconic arch. Ali Musser is there with her parents a day before graduating.
Oh my goodness. I'm scared. I'm excited. It's all there. All the feelings.
Musser got a job in Dallas, and although she's from Indiana, she says she can't wait to leave.
For me to come back to Indiana, it'd take a lot better weather and a definite pay raise on that.
Indiana struggles to retain highly skilled college graduates like Musser. Last year, Purdue and Indiana University Bloomington both estimated the majority of their graduates left the state. Notre Dame reported closer to 90% left. Adding to that, a congressional study published this year placed Indiana among the 10 worst states for losing highly educated workers. Timothy Zimmer is an economist at the University of Indianapolis. He says while it's great that the state produces so many college graduates, it's a bad sign that it can't retain them.
It would be like the state going out and investing and buying all this high-tech equipment and then turning around and sending all this high-tech equipment to other states.
To combat this, Indiana's launched a brain gain initiative out of Purdue, started by a former governor, and even a new law requiring state colleges to market Indiana jobs to students. But in the past year, one Indiana startup decided to take on that challenge with a very 21st century approach.
Hi, good morning. Is this Ashley?
Yes, this is Ed.
Yes, it is. Hey, Ashley, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for taking my call today.
That's Ed Sherman, VP of Talent Development and Talent Mapping, or simply TMAP. He's demonstrating with a coworker on the phone line how they reach out to potential job candidates and to see what it would take to get them to move to Indiana.
If I had to sum up what TMAP does in one sentence, our goal is to grow the Indiana economy.
Those phone calls aren't random. Sherman is pulling from a list of people TMAP generates after they scrape social media profiles and buy databases of information to find people with ties to Indiana. TMAP was started by Bill Osterley, the founder of another company made possible by the internet called Angie's List. He says the little online breadcrumbs we create when surfing the web can be used to target marketing for Indiana jobs.
Are they originally from the place? Did they go to Colts games? Did they talk about Indiana on Twitter? In a nutshell, the World Wide Web is a wonderful place to go get information about people.
Vanessa Raminski is one of the first job candidates TMAP found. She's from LaPorte and graduated from Indiana University, but for the past 15 years, she'd been living and working in Wisconsin as a buyer for a corporate retailer.
I actually thought for sure that there would be no opportunities for me that I would come back for.
When the company she worked at closed, she was referred to TMAP. Based on her career goals, they paired her with a startup in Indianapolis that helps retailers sell products on Amazon.
I mean, it was really exciting, and it was something that, wow, if that worked out, that would be kind of check a lot of our boxes. I wanted to really refocus my career on the future of retail, and it's great to be closer to family and friends.
And work out it did. Vanessa was one of about 40 people TMAP brought back to Indiana in its first year. Osterley says he hopes that with increased cooperation between TMAP, universities, and lawmakers, they can guide more graduates into Indiana jobs. With all their efforts combined, maybe, just maybe, Indiana can put a stopper in the brain drain. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Solving problems and coming up with resolutions at the city level is one of the reasons mayors from across the country get together at the United States Conference of Mayors. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke with Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson, who attended the event in Honolulu. She went to a climate change summit where mayors discussed their commitment to the original Paris Accord and to environmental stewardship. Other issues, including public safety and economic development, were also discussed. Here's the conversation.
So you are out in Hawaii.
I am.
At the United States Conference of Mayors. Now tell me about why you're there and what the objective is for the event.
So every summer, the U.S. Conference of Mayors comes together. We consider resolutions. We also look at best practices. As an example, yesterday there was a climate summit that was led and convened by Mayor Eric Garcetti from L.A. as well as Mayor Kirk Caldwell from Honolulu, where we addressed our commitment to the original Paris Accord that was addressing climate change and the issues of concern to all Americans relative to our stewardship around the environment, but also to talk about how do we reduce our carbon footprint as cities, how do we encourage our residents around environmental stewardship, what are some low-hanging fruit and what are some major changes that we can ascribe to and commit to so that as communities around the country, we can see changes. We've all had extreme weather events. We've all seen flooding. We've all seen tornadoes. We've all seen a variety of things such as extreme weather, both in the summer with the rain and in the winter with polar vortexes. So that was just one aspect of this meeting, but we will also deal with issues around public safety, around economic development, around issues relative to the opioid epidemic and vaping. And it's an opportunity to learn from our colleagues around the country. It's also an opportunity to contribute to other communities in those areas where I think we've seen successes. So it's an overall exchange that provides a benefit to communities all over. And, you know, it's an honor to be a part of it, something that I have been actively involved in for the last 8 years.
I know you just touched on it, but what do you think, how has the United States Conference of Mayors made things better in cities overall? Has it solved any major problems or improved on any major challenges?
Well, I think that it has certainly helped us in our relationships with the federal government. As an example, with the Environmental Protection Agency, many of us have consent decrees. Many of us know that it would be very costly to fully implement the measures that would be required in those consent decrees. Through our collective work, through exchange of information, through the U.S. Conference of Mayors, we've been able to mitigate those costs to our communities. So that's a major way. We also have all been challenged by many aspects of public safety. Some have seen police action shootings, and as a result of working with experts like Chuck Ramsey, who was the longstanding commissioner in Philadelphia, also the police chief in Washington, D.C., who has a tremendous expertise and has provided that as a consultant to the U.S. Conference of Mayors, but we're able to talk with him about issues of concern. In fact, most recently, I talked with him about the importance of being prepared for large-scale shootings and for being ready for those and how we can best train our police officers to respond to those crises that occur in some communities. And you know, we don't know that it will ever occur in our community. In fact, we hope that it doesn't. But if it does, we know we want our officers and our police forces to be trained. And the thing about it is that we don't necessarily have to bring everybody here, but by being able to become aware of the training, make the connections and the relationships, we're able to make sure that our officers are able to take advantage of it. I met Michael Bloomberg, as an example, at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and we know as a result of learning about his public art challenge, we were able to reactivate a somewhat abandoned building, an underperforming building, and lead to Art House, which has been a tremendous boost in that community, in our community.
What do you think is the biggest challenge and the biggest issue for United States mayors to confront and face?
Well, I think it depends on the city. I know that a number of us from Indianapolis to Louisville to other cities, Chicago, are confronted with public safety issues. But you also find those cities that are really concerned about economic mobility. You have portions of the city that are thriving, but you have other areas and other residents who are not. So how do we create an equitable opportunity for all of our residents? Housing is universal. And one of the things that I'll talk about today is housing. When I address the plenary session, is I'll talk about the efforts that we've done around a housing task force through NLC and the partnership that we anticipate from the U.S. Conference of Mayors with that effort. So I think that you find common themes in cities, no matter how large they are, how smart they are, small they are, and certainly the issues around housing is probably the number one concern that mayors have, whether it is homelessness or affordability or gentrification. All of those issues are being faced around this country.
Is there any topic that is pertinent to Gary that you're going to be bringing up at the conference?
Yes. One of the things that I will be talking about is housing, and we've got some developments underway. But yesterday, as we talked about climate change, when we started 8 years ago, there was a lot more beach at Marquette. Now we've probably have half of the beach that we once had. So the erosion of our shoreline is one of the major issues that is being confronted, not just in cities like Gary, but also in Miami. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how do we address that issue. I'll talk about public safety and my concerns around just getting citizens engaged because, you know, you can hire 300 police officers, but if there are no witnesses who will cooperate with officers so that prosecutors can in turn bring cases to trial and convict people, then you can't create the deterrent that we know exists by not only detecting crime, but holding those responsible accountable for the crimes that they commit. We expect resolutions to come out at this time that will assist us both in dealing with the census, with concerns relative to border security, with concerns relative to fair trade. There are also other issues that I'm sure will come before the conference that will be of relevance to not just Gary citizens, but all citizens all over Northwest Indiana.
Is there any items on the agenda that will work out in Gary's favor that will help the city of Gary?
Yes, I think certainly the work that we will be doing around public safety will be something that I will be able to bring back to Gary and that will benefit Gary citizens.
And what are you going to do after you're no longer mayor?
That has yet to be determined, but there are some really good opportunities on the horizon. You know, one of the things is that I am really proud of the record of accomplishments that we've created over the last 8 years. And, you know, whenever you do something, go somewhere, you want to leave it better than you found it. We have been able to do that. And so I am comfortable. You know, nobody ever runs to lose, but I'm comfortable moving into the next assignment. And I think that certainly serving as mayor was an assignment, was a divine assignment, and I'm just waiting on the next one.
Do you think you'll run for office of some kind?
It is very unlikely. You never say never, but there would have to be a whole lot of things to happen. And at this juncture, you know, after serving in a public capacity in one way or another, elected or appointed for 30 years, I think I've discharged my duty of public service.
Are you still going to live in Gary?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I've been there all my life, with the exception of my time in Washington, but, you know, in Indianapolis. But, yeah, I don't anticipate moving.
Where did you live when you went to Harvard?
I lived in Cambridge, but I was still a Gary resident. I was just a student then.
Did you live in the dorms?
Yeah. I lived in the dorm as an undergraduate and then an apartment as a grad student.
So you don't have anything specific to say about what you're going to be doing?
I do not. It's still a few months to, you know, that I have to determine that.
All right. Well, will you let us know?
I will. I will absolutely let you know.
Great.
And thank you for asking.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Jim Weiser, chairman of the Lake County Democratic Party.
There are a number of new names or maybe even some new faces showing up in the politics here in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular in the last election. And a lot of these young people, and some are old people, but many are young people who are interested in getting involved in public office. We'll find out more about this new crop of candidates who are going to be up on the ballot for the November general election. Jim Weiser is the Lake County Democratic Party chairman, and he joins us. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Looking forward to it.
Now, I understand this is all of the effort that the Lake County Democratic Party has been making in recent months to try to recruit new candidates to be on public office. Is there any reason, obviously, just to maybe just have more people on the ballot, that we're finding more people that are coming in interested in running for public office?
Well, I think, Chris, it's a combination of a couple of things. We made a concerted effort in 2018, first of all, to start out with our organization and try to encourage younger people to get involved by becoming possibly precinct committeemen or vice committeemen and getting involved with the party. So that's kind of where it began. And then we started also to try to recruit candidates. And we discovered that in 2018, there seemed to be a lot of interest. I'm sure it's sparked by what's occurring nationally, a lot of interest. And we ended up just by our recruiting efforts and by networking, getting candidates to run for office like younger, like you said, there's younger people, there's new faces. That we got Chris Chung, who ran in the 15th district and beat an incumbent that folks said couldn't be beat when he beat Hal Slager. We recruited Lisa Beck, who's done an outstanding job as a legislator who won her district over Julie Olthoff. We recruited Reagan Hatcher to run for state representative. Of course, Eddie Melton has been there for a while. But it was an effort to get people more engaged and younger people and new people committed to the Democratic ideals and principles. And it's, so far as you can tell, it's been working really well. Mm-hmm.
Go through the list of communities that you and your colleagues with the Lake County Democratic Party have been asking people to become members of the electorate and in turn becoming public officials if they get elected. Go through the communities to tell us about some of the people that have decided to get on the ballot in the cities and towns around the area.
Sure, I'm happy to do that, Chris. I'll kind of start on the northwest side and work my way east.
Okay.
In Hammond, you may note that two new folks, Barry Tyler and Katrina Alexander, both won primaries over long-term incumbents and did it by grassroots, I mean, totally grassroots organizations. Both of them are very young people, both of them very engaged in their community. They're going to be, I think, great additions to the Hammond City Council. In Gary, for example, we have two more people, Ty Atkins, a young lady who ran. Now, that was an open seat because Carolyn Rogers didn't run for re-election in the 4th District. But there were, my recollection is, five or six candidates, and Ty came out successful. young lady, 32 years old, Gary Westside graduate. I played college basketball. She's just a very smart, dynamic young lady. Then Bill Godwin, who won in the first district in Gary, another bright young face. Then over in Lake Station, Bill Carroll, who won for won the primary for mayor, again another open seat, is a young man, young businessman, and was recruited because he was just interested in his community. He owns a business in the community. It's successful. He wants to keep it that way, and he wants to do what's well. Then kind of moving back over in Munster, we recruited a young lady who's running for clerk treasurer, and her name's Jennifer Pizzuto Dean. And she's a very bright young lady, a Munster resident virtually her whole life, and again, someone who wanted to get active and got very involved in having talked to her numerous times, very involved in national concerns about national politics. She wanted to translate it into local, have a local impact. In Highland, we just caucused in to replace Dan Vassar, who decided after a very successful term as a councilman that he wanted to spend more time with his family and pursue other interests. We caucused in a young man named Martin Del Rio, 32 years old, a veteran, works in Veterans Affairs, as a matter of fact, bright young guy who I think is just going to fit in really well, and that's something that's near and dear to my heart since I spent two terms on the Highland Town Council in my former life. I'm really pleased about Martin being involved. We have out in Crown Point, now I'm jumping around a little, a young man, Zach Bryan, 28 years old, born and raised in the community, Andrean grad, got an MBA, and he's the general manager of Crown Brewing, which is the family-owned, his family-owned business. Here in Schererville, for example, we have two new faces and relatively young faces, too. Vanessa Welty running in the 5th Council District, and Robin Arvanitis running in, I think that's the 3rd District. Believe me, Chris, it hasn't been that difficult recruiting these folks. When you get out there and you let them know that you want, we always start out with the premise that this is for your community. Mm-hmm. This isn't necessarily, although we like it to be for the Democratic Party, but this is a way to give back to your community and to do for your community. And we knew people that have volunteered, people that were involved in their community, so we went out and recruited them, and fortunately have been very, very successful.
Are they finding that in most cases that these are people that are very well aware of the fact that they're going to have to work hard to go out there and campaign, maybe? There may be, luckily, in communities where there are Democratic majorities, but they may be in some places where there are still a lot of Republicans that are still in office, and they're going to have to go out there and convince people that they're willing to take the job and they're worthy of taking the job.
Well, that's a great point, Chris. We don't give them any false illusions. We don't go out there and tell them, you know, that it's going to be a walk in the park. We let them know that it's challenging in any community, and particularly in those communities, for example, where Zach Bryan's running, where it's, I don't even think that Crown Point's ever had a majority Democratic council. I don't believe they have. So, and he's running at large. And he knows the challenges ahead. I spent not only myself, but others spent many hours talking to Zach about what it would take. And what I've always said, Chris, and I point this out to people that ask me often about Chris Chung. Well, you know, how does a 26-year-old young man who's never been involved in government or politics, how does that happen? And it's always my premise that the first and foremost thing is you've got to have a committed candidate. You've got to have a candidate that I say has the fire burning in the belly. That's what you have to determine. It can't be something where someone says, geez, you know, if you don't have anybody else, maybe I'll think about doing it or I might do it. No, that isn't what works. What works is somebody that says, I want to do this. I have a desire to do this. I have a plan to do this. This is what I think. That's what's needed. And that's and those are the kind of people, those are the kind of folks I think we've got running now. And that's why I feel so good about it, because they're in it for the right reasons. They're in it because they want to do it. They're in it because they want to serve their communities. They don't hold any illusions about that it's going to be a cakewalk or anything. They know, and they have been since the primary, all working very, very hard.
Are there any spots left on the ballot in any of the communities coming up here that will have to be filled before the deadline?
No, actually the deadline occurred.
Okay, so it has passed. So everybody's on the ballot that's going to be on the ballot, and I suppose
correct.
It's time to get the ballots together and ready to go. When they are facing some formidable opponents in communities, as we say, the communities will say that have a number of Republicans on the ballot, or if they're just going out there and having to really, really work hard to become members of the council or commissioners, and not commissioners necessarily, but council certainly, to be sure, since we're talking city and town elections this time around, are there any opportunities that they're out there for people that maybe are just kind of thinking about whether they really want to run for office? They can kind of get experience in working as members of at the polls or any place like that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Chris, we've set up a program, and I'm meeting with a number of the folks next Wednesday the 10th, kind of like an organizational meeting, and we've come up with an idea sort of put together by Chris Chung and myself, and along with the help of the my precinct organization and our officers, to put together sort of an internship program. And we've got a number of young people that are seniors in high school, freshmen in college, young folks that want to work and get involved in government and in politics. So what we said is, well, here's another way you can do it. There's no precinct positions, or at least there's not a race for precinct positions now. So, but here's what you can do. Get involved in a campaign. Get involved in helping out candidates and in helping out our organization. And so we've got a number of people we've recruited in that regard. We're going to have the meeting here at my office next Wednesday to get them started, and we're going to assign them throughout the county to help out certain candidates and certain campaigns where we think that the Democrats have a very good chance of winning or preserving seats, particularly, for example, Crown Point, also in Lowell, where I think we have a really good chance of winning a majority of councilmen in Lowell. So in those areas where traditionally Democrats have had, the Democratic Party has struggled a bit in the past, we don't think we're going to struggle anymore. We think that we relate to what people believe. We get people out there working, going door to door, and going to events, and going to functions, and letting them know who these candidates are and why they want to serve their community. So, yes, there's plenty of opportunity for other people to get involved.
What do some of the incumbents, their Democrats, think about these people that are coming up in the ranks and, as you say, becoming going to be, I guess, in a way, assistants, certainly to the candidates that are out there? What do the old-timers or the old hands seem to think about the idea of bringing a younger, more inexperienced but anxious and very, very willing people and want to become public office?
That's interesting. There's always that dynamic there. And that sort of not necessarily conflict, but there is that kind of push and shove there between those that have been in office or those that have been in politics for quite some time and those that haven't. But I mean, look at myself, Chris. I'm not a spring chicken here. I've done this a long time. I'm absolutely convinced that more than ever, there's a in the Democratic Party as a whole, nationally and statewide, we have a generation gap. And those of us of the generation that for a long time were at the top of the heap and were controlling things just need to recognize that it's a new day. And I don't mean necessarily a wholesale change, because there's a whole lot to be said for institutional knowledge and experience. Don't get me wrong. We've got great, right now, people bridging the generational gaps who are good public officials, take our sheriff, Oscar Martinez, or take our county commissioner, Mike Repay. I mean, folks like that who are not on the super young side, but yet bridge that gap and have shown and demonstrate to these younger folks how people can serve the community and can serve Northwest Indiana. But what we've done is, I think we've kind of eased into it a little bit, and we've had a lot of discussion about it and a lot of meetings over it. And those old timers, as you say, understand that there's a new generation coming along, and as long as we get good, qualified young people and they see that these folks are there for the right reasons and the right intentions and have a lot of energy to offer, they know that it, in the long run, it helps all of us. So it hasn't been as difficult to start working on that change as, quite frankly, I thought it was going to be.
That's good news. That's good news. We'll look forward to seeing these new candidates out on the campaign trail in the communities around Lake County, looking for votes, looking for supporters. And we appreciate you sitting down and talking over some of this information with them, as well as offering this information to us to give us some insight as to what these new candidates are really like and how interested they really seem to be in wanting to become public office. And we hope to we'll see what happens, of course, in the November election. We hope that many succeed.
Well, thank you, Chris. It was great talking to you, and happy to do it anytime.
Thanks, Jim. Jim Weiser is Lake County Democratic Party Chairman. You're listening to Regionally Speaking.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.